Wrong.
Should it make any difference to me that only half the class is here? One of the essay questions for the final exam will be to provide an example of development that makes the interconnectedness of biological, cognitive, and psychosocial development clear. Okay. In other words, an essay on any part of the lifespan, any development, an event or a transition, any kind of change, explaining it in such a way that you make clear the interconnectedness, how the three domains are related, the biological, cognitive, and psychosocial. What? Just draw a picture. It's just one example. Any kind of change. You'll recognize it when it gets there. Any kind of change, any place in the lifespan that makes the interconnectedness of the three domains clear. Okay. Yes? Sure. Yeah. Any change, any transition. Okay. Two units down, one to go. We're in the home stretch. This is the long one. This is where things start to fall into place and come together so you can answer that essay question. And this is the one that I hope I warned you about the first day that has twice as much reading as each of the others. Okay, so we're about 60% through the lectures. Maybe two-thirds, not quite two-thirds, 60%. And we're only halfway through the reading. So, but you've adapted. Cold weather's coming. You have nothing else to do but read the text and study, so it's okay. We will finish grading the exams as quickly as we can and get them back to you. Yes, there will be another exam analysis exercise for the second exam. And if you failed to do, or chose not to do, sorry, it wasn't failure, you chose not to do the first one, you'll have another chance. You can do the first one on the second exam. And if you did the first one, then you can go ahead and do the second one. The instructions will be different, the questions will be different a little bit for the second one, and it'll be worth 5 points. So plan for that. And remind me to put that on the website. Okay, anything else? Housekeeping? Questions? Okay. Where are we? Other than in MLS 235. This is the unit where we're going to go back through. We're going to go back to the beginning now. We've been through the biological, the cognitive. You've thought about how those two go together. And now we're going to go back and look at the psychosocial or psychological and interpersonal domain and take that through the lifespan, again making connections to the other two domains as we go along. So let's review a little bit. What did we learn about the first domain? You've seen this, same one. we suggested that physical development or biological development is orderly and progressive and has a genetic basis. It's governed by the processes of differentiation and integration, both in structure and in function. It's influenced by transactions with the environment. This biological organism is acting, eating, breathing, doing all of those things, and what it is breathing and what it has to act on, what kinds of challenges it has in the environment, and how those transact with the specific structures and functions that the organism has developed lead to development. The organism adapts to circumstances, improves with practice, degrades with disuse, misuse, or abuse. There are variations in style and skill, in the way we use our bodies. Biological development differs a bit by sex, differs by socioeconomic status and race, and we're born with species-specific preparation for the expectable environment. We come into the environment of the Earth, and we're adapted to it. And I promised at the beginning of that second unit that we would probably find some of the same things happening in the cognitive realm. So I hope you came away from the second unit at least struggling to find some order and progressiveness in cognitive development. It does go along through stages in a fairly predictable way. It's dependent on and based on brain function and development. Cognitive development and differences in our thinking have a genetic basis. The brain and our thinking and language all represent species-specific preparations for that expectable environment. We adapt to circumstances. Transactions with the environment lead to knowledge and understanding. Differentiation and integration are still there as we apply them to information and schemes and concepts. There are varieties of style and skill, Gardner's notion of multiple intelligences, differences in IQ, differences in the kinds of skills that we develop. Generally, there's improvement through practice, degradation through disuse, use it or lose it, one of those, whichever makes sense. There are socioeconomic status differences. Some of us have more opportunity for experience to construct understanding out of than others, and our socioeconomic status contributes to that, doesn't necessarily determine it, but it's an index. There is potential for development throughout life. We didn't say that about the biological development domain, but I would go back and add it. And physical health and fitness affect the cognitive fitness. So as the brain deteriorates in old age, we see declines in cognitive functioning. Okay, so most of that's familiar, I hope. Good. So, what are we going to promise? What will we learn? And I'm predictable enough that I apply the same schemas. I'm going to try to convince you that our interpersonal development, our psychosocial development is orderly and progressive. We're going to look for dependency or reflections of biological development and brain development. We're going to look for dependency or reflection of cognitive development. We're going to look for species-specific preparations for the expectable environment, especially relationships with others. The organism comes into the world ready to become social. We're going to look at how we adapt to circumstances. I'm going to argue that we construct meaning and relationships from the specific transactions we have with other people. Just as we did physically, we developed our skills and transactions with the physical environment. We developed our knowledge and cognitive skills through our transactions with experience and knowledge. We're going to construct meaning and relationships in our lives from our transactions with other people. We're going to see differentiation and integration again. We're going to see them this time applied to emotions and relationships, self-concept and identity. We're going to see variations in style. You know, fortunately, we don't all develop the same kinds of relationships and do it in the same way. Life might be easier if we did, but it's more fun this way. We improve through practice, I think. We'll look at some exceptions to that in some sorts of areas. Too much practice is not good for you. We'll look at that. We'll see socioeconomic status differences. We'll see degradation through disuse and abuse. I think we'll see potential for interpersonal development or psychosocial development throughout the lifespan. We will see that physical health and fitness affect our third domain, the psychosocial, and we'll see that cognitive health and fitness affect our interpersonal relationships. Okay, so that's where we're going. And if you're formal operational, you can see some isomorphism between that set of relationships and the other two, I hope. Okay, so what are we going to focus on? I'm editing myself here. Yeah, okay, we'll do it this way. Yeah. Focus questions. These are the questions that if you ask them and can provide elaborative answers to as we go through this unit, as you apply it to the reading that you're doing, keep these in mind, keep them in the background. You'll get most of the concepts that I'm hoping we can agree on. What is temperament? How do we become emotionally connected to other people? Why do other people matter? And why do some people really matter? Why are they really important to us? What differences do parents make? How do peer relationships change across the lifespan? From infancy right on up through the lifespan, we can see changes in how our relationships with our peers change. How does physical development affect psychosocial development? I said what we are going to learn is that there is some reflection. That's the question of how. How does cognitive development affect the psychosocial development? What happens as you develop cognitive skills? What happens to your interpersonal relationships? As you become a critical thinker in adolescence, what happens to your relationships with parents and peers and others? And on the other side, how does psychosocial development affect physical development and cognitive development? What difference does it make that you have interpersonal skills or attachments to other people? Does that affect your physical development? Does it affect your health? Yes. How? How does it affect your cognitive development? What is maturity? You're all completely developed, right? Your parents are convinced that you're completely mature. You're convinced you're completely mature. What does that mean? What does it mean to be mature? How do family relationships change across the lifespan? How do they affect development? A couple of questions to take home with you or in your conversations with parents. Ask your parents, what difference it has made in their development to have raised you. Question is, what impact does parenting have on people's development? If you happen to have two parents, some of us do, if you still have two parents, which some of us do, ask them how their relationship with each other has influenced their development. So the general question is, how does partnering up with somebody, a particular somebody in your parents' cases, affect their development? How have they been changed by being partnered up? How does the work you do affect your development? And when I think about work in this context, the text tends to talk about work in relationship to cognitive development. I'm more interested in the interpersonal situation or context that you spend your life in. If you have to work, or how does not having to work for a living, lucky you, change your life? How does it affect your development? You think about vocations, or I'm going to call it your place in the world. How does that impact your development? And what we're going to look at briefly is how the transactions that are possible or required in the kind of work or social service or enterprise that you're involved in, how do those transactions influence your development? And how do you construct a life? Constructivist point of view. How do you put it together? Is it an intentional process? Is it an accidental process? Is it random? Is there any kind of predictability to it? How important is it that you know at your age what you're going to be doing when you're 60? 50? 30? 25? How important is it to your parents that you know what you're going to be doing 5 years from now? Probably much more important to them than it is to you. We'll chat a bit about whether that's a reasonable thing for them to expect or for you to spend a lot of time worrying about. It may be, I'm not denying that it is. Important concepts for you to be clear about and watch for as you go through the reading. We're going to be talking about emotion, temperament, attachment, transactions, generally interpersonal transactions, self-concept, roles, identity, and intimacy. We'll probably throw in some others, but I expect you to be able to use those in sentences in talking about people and development. Okay. Now that we've got all three domains at least started, let me introduce or reintroduce the sort of where we're going, what I would like you to be able to do concept as you go through this domain and try to relate it to the others. What I would like you to be able to do in your lives, the rest of your lives, is to take any development or event in your life or somebody else's life, a client's life, a patient's life, your kid's life, your partner's life, your parent's life, anybody's life, and think about what is going on in all three domains. And on the website, there's a list of events or transitions with this paradigm, this format, and then suggestions about what might be happening in each of the domains, recognizing that a particular transition might be primarily biological or primarily cognitive or primarily interpersonal, but the contention of the human developer is that if something happens in one domain, it's likely to affect what goes on in the other two domains. So we're going to be trying through this unit, and one of the reasons it's a bit longer than the others, is that we're going to be trying to put these together and think about how the domains transact with each other at particular points. Because that's what I'd like you to be able to do. I'd like you, as a teacher, if that's where you go, I'd like you to be able to think about what's going on biologically for a kid who's learning to walk, or a kid who's becoming formal operational. I'd like you to be able to think about the intellectual skills as just part of the changes that are going on in the child's life. So when you learn to walk, it changes your interpersonal relationships. It also changes, potentially, your biology. When you become formal operational, it helps you in algebra, but it also changes your interpersonal relationships. And it may have an impact on your biology. Or it may be based on changes in the brain. Okay? So we're going to try to find other examples. If you go into nursing, which some of you expect to do, your patients come in with physical problems typically. But most of us go into the hospital and go to our doctor because we have a physical problem. But we have the other two domains. And one of the goals in the nursing program is that as you look at a person who's had a heart attack, you are also aware of not just the biological adaptation that's taking place, but also how the client is able to think about that, what it's doing to cognitive skills, what the medications might be doing, and then what it implies for the psychosocial domain. Is the psychosocial domain involved in the fact that this heart attack happened? Why is there a disproportionate number of heart attacks on Mondays? Why? What is going on in a person's psychosocial world that is connected to the incidence of heart attacks on different days of the week? Why does a person not follow the prescriptions, the regimen that is set out? Why would a person not do that? Simple biological instructions. Do this, do this, do this, and you'll get better. You'll live, maybe. Do these things. What kind of thinking would lead a person to not do the things that would make him or her survive? What kind of interpersonal relationships might interfere with compliance with prescriptions, and with the regimen, the medical regimen? Okay. Those are sorts of things that you should be able to apply in your clinical practice to understand why people do or not do things that they're told to do. Okay, we'll look at lots of examples of that, and I'm going to try to come back to those every once in a while. One that we talked about briefly birth. We talked about the biological adaptations. We didn't really talk about the cognitive, but when you're born, you get to start having transactions with the external world, not just your father or the alleged father making whale noises outside the uterus on the abdomen. We saw that. That's a kind of a sensory motor experience, but you actually get to go out in that world and begin to kick it and have transactions with it and develop schemas about what is familiar and what is not. You begin the process of cognitive development. You also change attachments from the umbilical attachment, the biological one, to hopefully being in a situation where you can create a social attachment with caregivers. But you have to bridge the gap now, because you're no longer inside and you're no longer, in fact, physically attached to the caregiving person. And you may, in fact, be taken care of by somebody who has never been attached to you physically. you may be, in fact, required to, or given the opportunity to form an attachment, social attachment, interpersonal attachment, a mattering to each other with somebody who has no biological relationship with you at all. How does that happen? Okay, so that's an example. All of those things are happening. Birth is primarily biological, but it has major implications for the other two domains. I'm not going to beat that one to death, but look at the examples at the end of the website and think about those as we go through this unit. Okay, where are we? Here we go. We're going to go back to birth, and I'm going to argue that this domain, interpersonal domain, is very strongly connected to biological, and in fact that's where we begin to see the interpersonal development. We might begin to see it in the parents, but I suspect that the fetus has very little awareness that there is anybody else out there. The parents are developing quite a relationship with the expected child. They're choosing names, they're choosing colors, they're developing an image. Those of you who've had HDFS 60 remember reading about creating an image of what this baby is going to be like, and then at birth having to modify that and make sense out of what you really got, because it may not quite be isomorphic with what you expected. But what happens at birth for the infant is that the infant comes out. You saw this before. You saw the physical foundation in vision, preference for face, the ability to distinguish very quickly between familiar and unfamiliar people, and the tendency to look at faces and respond to them, which is the beginning of that sense of attachment with us that the infant is beginning to create. Ah, you're familiar. There's something nice about that, I hope. Or you're familiar and I want to stay away from you, depending on how the adult is acting. Hearing, listening to the voices, being able to discriminate familiar and unfamiliar voices very quickly, and then over the course of infancy trying to figure out the connection between the voice and the face, the content of the voice, what it is actually saying, and the world that you're being exposed to. And finally, touch. Responding to being held, being stroked, smooth touch, soft touch, or responding to vigorous touch and displacements and swinging and rocking and being thrown up in the air, all of those things that some infants, particularly the boys, like. And in those responses to the physical contact with the caregivers, beginning to establish reciprocity and a relationship that becomes part of the attachment or the avoidance. And what's happening to both the parent and the child as you are watching, talking to, listening to, imitating, moving with, and creating those games, that both the parent and the child are developing an emotional response to each other. Familiarity is providing a sense of comfort, contentment, if the transaction that they're having is comforting and doesn't produce anxiety, if it's predictable and expectable and meets your needs. Or a negative emotional response to people who don't do what you expect or don't do things that you're comfortable with. So in the infant's emotional response to the caregiving practices of the caregivers, parents or others, you begin to see, again, the beginning of the foundation for the emotional attachment that may be formed. It doesn't have to be formed, but it may be formed. And it may be positive, it may be negative. Okay. Shuffle them, Larry. It works better if you have them in order when you start and then just shuffle them. Keeps me thinking. Okay. Biology provides the foundation. Biology gives us a genetic basis for two of the very important determinants of the kind of relationships we will have, self-concept that we develop, the nature of the transactions that we will have in the social world. Temperament, which we're going to talk about a bit today, our emotional style, and gender. We come into the world biologically male or female or something close to that. And from that we construct gender. And whether you're male or female begins to determine the nature of the transactions you have with other people immediately. Instantly. Is it a boy? Is it a girl? And they may already know that, and then it gets confirmed at birth. They may know that from the sonograms. And then it gets confirmed, and parents, no matter how well-meaning, no matter whether they're male or female, will treat you differently, even if they don't want to. They will treat you differently depending on whether they think you're a boy or a girl. People who don't know your gender, don't know what biological sex you are, will vary depending on what they're told. So if you tell them it's a girl and it's really a boy and it's wearing a diaper and they can't tell, they will treat you differently if they're told you're a girl than they will if they're told you're a boy. The research on that is absolutely fascinating. Even among wonderfully educated feminist men and women who believe that there shouldn't be any differences in, unnecessary differences in the way we treat males and females, will treat babies differently depending on whether they think the baby is a boy or a girl. So no matter how you think you're not sexist, at least entertain the notion that you do differentiate. We live in a gendered world. We grow up in a gendered world. It is a gendered world in every aspect of our lives. And biology makes a difference. Even the assumed biology makes a difference in the case of that research. Biology also provides the foundation for emotion. Emotions are physiological responses to situations. I'm hungry, I'm an infant, I'm going to cry. If somebody doesn't come to my assistance, I'm going to cry harder. If things happen to me as an infant that I don't understand and aren't predictable and scare me, I'm going to get anxious. And I'm going to gradually learn the cognitive piece. I'm going to learn to associate particular situations with particular people. And I'm going to demonstrate to you very quickly that some people can make me anxious before they do much, as long as I recognize who they are. If I've had experience with them, I have a scheme for the person that includes my emotional reaction, and I can become anxious. Biology also prepares me to respond to the emotions of other people. So infants come into the world with the potential to catch other people's emotions. So if you put them with a mother who's particularly upset and anxious and scared, the infant will catch that emotion. Emotions are contagious. And in any situation where we are with other people who are experiencing strong emotions, we will catch their emotions. We will feel them. The beginning of empathy is in that built-in ability. So we can understand somebody else's emotions because we can feel other people's emotions. We can do that as infants, and that's biologically built in. Infants show us different emotions as their brains mature. The text describes someplace along the way about page, I don't know, in the section on emotions, page 193 to 198, describes the brain changes over the first couple of years of life. It probably goes a little farther than that. That underlie the expression of different emotions. So what we're seeing in infancy is a primitive set of emotions based on an immature brain. And as the biological development continues and the brain becomes more developed and more sophisticated, it allows the experience and the expression of different emotions. So part of the interpersonal development that we're seeing, the psychosocial development that we're seeing in infancy and toddlerhood, is a changing set of emotional expressions. And since other people are responding to our emotions and what we're expressing, those biological changes alter the transactions that other people are having with us. So as babies become more expressive of their emotions become more differentiated, their transactions with their caregivers change. And caregivers recognize that, so they change the way they respond to babies. So biology gives us that beginning foundation, and that continues, and we'll explore as we go along how biological changes influence the kinds of relationships that we have. The cognitive domain is underlying the sense that we're making out of our social experience. Arguably, our most important experiences in infancy are with other people, with our caregivers, the people who interact with us on a regular basis. The mind is providing us the basis for making sense out of the interpersonal interactions we're having. The mind is giving us the potential to understand ourselves as the brain matures enough for us to understand that we have a self, which comes along later than you might think. You all know, maybe you don't know. If you read the Free Press yesterday, you do know. How we test for whether or not an organism is self-aware. Put it in front of a mirror. The elephant. Elephants have been demonstrated to be aware of being, okay, self-awareness. Chimpanzees, primates generally, some of them do, we certainly do. And you do that with a kid, it's really fun. You take a bit of lipstick or red paint, makeup, and you put a spot on the kid's head or on the cheek and put the kid in front of a mirror, and you get the evidence of self-awareness when the kid sees the spot and knows that it's on her. And you know that because the kid will look at it and touch it here, instead of looking at it and touching it on the mirror. If you touch it on the mirror, you're just touching a spot on an image. But if you see it in the mirror and then touch yourself, we take that as evidence of being self-aware, aware that you exist. And that doesn't happen until late in the first year. But Free Press reported wonderful research on elephants. Put them in front of a mirror, put a spot on them, and they look at it. Put them in front of a mirror, they examine their own ears. They touch the spot that you put on them with their trunk, which is their major sensory organ. Of the elephants? Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry? I didn't hear. That's where you saw it. BBC.com. So you, I know. Old fashioned. Newspaper. Everything I know comes from the Free Press. That would be scary. Our cognitive skills give us the basis for understanding all of our relationships with other people, or understanding other people generally. Other people are a phenomenon to be understood, like math, or numbers, or train A leaves the station in Paris at whatever. People are objects to be understood cognitively. So instead of train A leaving the station at a particular time, it's my friend Beth does X, Y, and Z. Harry does W, X, and whatever. They're doing different things. How do I understand that? They respond differently to me. They respond differently in different situations. I have two siblings. These are hypothetical examples. I have two siblings. One of them is a wonderful, devoted parent. The other one is pretty neglectful and incompetent at parenting. They're both male. How do I explain that? How do I explain that? And then how do I understand me if I'm the third brother in the family? How do I understand the difference between us? Understanding other people and their motivations and their behavior and their characteristics and their temperaments and their personalities is probably the most complex thinking we ever do. Probably the most complex, because people are so complex. Yeah. Iraq and Iran, they're pretty simple. Even North Korea, pretty simple. You? Wow. What a complex group of people. Very different. Wonderful. Understanding of our social transactions. Remember in talking about cognitive development, and talked about being able to place, to put two things, two different frames of reference together. The train A, train B. We saw it in the number analyses. In order to understand our transactions with other people, or to talk about relationships transactionally, we have to be able to coordinate our understanding of ourselves and our own behavior, and another person and his or her behavior. And talk about what happens between. That's the transaction. The relationship is not the other person. The relationship is not me. The relationship is what happens together. It's what we create through our transaction, through our mutual behavior. That's a fairly complex cognitive concept. And it's very difficult to get kids to understand that there are two parties to a relationship. If you're the disciplinarian in an elementary school, you know this. It's hard enough to get the kid to understand his or her own behavior, but then getting them to understand somebody else's behavior is a challenge, and then understanding how they work together is almost impossible. So concrete operational kids blame other people for whatever happened, if there's punishment involved. Or they take credit if there's no punishment involved. They'll take the responsibility and forget that it might have been a collaborative transaction that led to something good. But as we become adolescents, we expect, using formal operational skills, that we can talk about relationships in a way that allows us to say anything good that happens in this relationship is a mutual product. It takes two to make a relationship. And you don't take all the credit for it. Or you don't give all of the blame to somebody else. It takes two. And the relationship doesn't exist unless both people are acting in it in relationship to each other. That's a much more sophisticated cognitive skill, but it's essential to understanding relationships. Cognitive skills provide the basis for understanding our relationship in our social context, beyond relationships. How do I fit myself as a developing adult into a potential career? That's not biological. It's not simply cognitive. If it were, you'd all be in the right major. You know, we'd just assign you there. It's about putting your identity into a social context that's very complex and understanding that you will be able to adapt and enjoy and be satisfied by and be productive in a particular career. That's a really complex cognitive skill. It's a very complex cognitive process to figure out what to do with your life, if you try to figure it out and make plans and choose a major. Some of us get along better if we just fall into things that are fortunate and not have to worry about planning. The world puts opportunities in your path and you take them. And when they work out well, you enjoy them. And when they don't, you bail. That's one way to plan your life, or not. Okay, as we develop cognitive skills through childhood and adolescence and into adulthood, our relational potentials change. So the connection between the domains is that the sort of relationship that I can have with another person depends on our mutual cognitive skills. So think about the cognitive skills of 2 4-year-olds trying to have a friendship. Think about the cognitive skills of 2 15-year-olds, formal operational, trying to have a friendship or create something more in the relationship. Think about the cognitive skills of 2 25-year-olds trying to have a friendship and being able to relate to each other. Think about the cognitive skills of a 25-year-old and a 4-year-old. They're not the same. And the difference, in fact, shapes the kind of relationship they will have. So if you're a parent thinking about having children, one of the things that you have to, or you eventually do, get slapped in the face with is that the nature of that relationship is very dependent on the cognitive skills of the child. And the child's development of cognitive skills drives the problems that you have as a parent, the challenges that you face, the things that you have to do as a parent in order to cope with the child and provide appropriate parenting. You do not parent a 4-year-old the same way you parent an 8-year-old. Because the child is now concrete operational. You don't parent and you don't have the same relationship with a 10-year-old that you have with a 15-year-old. It's a very different relationship. The parent hasn't changed all that much cognitively. But when the child goes from being concrete operational to formal operational, you can bet that they have changed and the relationship will have changed. Productive parenting involves being aware of the child's cognitive skills and changing the relationship and your expectations of the relationship to respect those improvements in cognitive skills and to help them along and to acknowledge them in your relationship. In 60, you read the stages of parenthood, being driven by changes in the child, especially cognitive skills. Or if you didn't take six, you can take it next semester and we'll read that and elaborate on it more. The kinds of relationships that siblings have is often driven by where they are cognitively and the differences between them. So if you look at conflict between siblings, how many of you experienced significant conflict with siblings? Did it come and go? Yeah. It's predictable. And it's very helpful for parents to understand that when two kids are in the same cognitive stage, when they're both pre-operational, they can play together and get along together, and they may have rivalry between them. But as one of the, if they're different ages, as one of them becomes concrete operational, that child will begin to have much more conflict with the younger and vice versa, because they're moving into different stages and they don't think alike. They're different. And the 7-year-old looks at the 4-year-old or 5-year-old who's not yet concrete operational and says, "Man, are you dumb? You're really dumb. We have the same amount of candy. Mine's just in a different shape. Duh. I didn't add any. I didn't take anything away. Can't you conserve?" And the 5-year-old says, "I don't know what you're talking about. I hate you." Because they can't understand each other. The favorite time for conflict between siblings is when one of them goes through puberty. Become formal operational, and you've got this baby, concrete operational kid who just doesn't think like you at all. And the conflict goes up. I speak from personal experience. Our children were 2.5 years apart. And so they were both pre-operational at the same time and great buddies, played together, had a great time. Then Gwen became concrete operational and her little brother couldn't understand her. And we didn't divorce them. Close. And then we wanted to divorce the kids. And then they were both concrete operational together for about 3 years and they were best buds and they had great time playing games, and the gender differences created problems between them, but the cognitive differences didn't. And then Gwen became pubescent and formal operational. And I can explain some of the dents in the wall. Some of them got there, I don't know how, but I know there was conflict between the two of them as they didn't understand each other. And then they both became formal operational, and again, they figured out, okay, now we're both formal operational. They didn't know the phrase, but I tried to teach them. But they could think alike, so they could still have arguments, they could still have difference, but the arguments were on the same level. And then the gender differences came out again, and that was the basis for the conflict, but they at least understood it, and they could have an argument that was based on their different interpretations of the world, but they weren't differences in thinking, which drove them to be at blows with each other. And now they're both adults, and I love them dearly, and they get along really, really well. It's amazing. I recommend that you not marry somebody who is concrete operational. The relational potential conflict, the conflict in the relations is potentially a problem. Okay, so what I've said so far is that we have a biological basis for our relationships. There's a cognitive basis for our psychosocial development and our relationships. And then at some point we're going to have to look at how those two work together. Particularly thinking about emotion, physiological responses to situations, and our thinking, as we understand situations differently, our emotional responses change. How do we put our emotional responses and our thinking together. And what is the relationship between those two? Well, emotions are kind of fun because they really get in the way of thinking. Sometimes. And one of our challenges, we'll talk about more on Monday, one of our challenges is how to deal with strong emotions. Because the difficulty we have when we have very strong, particularly negative emotions, is that they interfere with our thinking. They shape our thinking in ways that we may not like. So when you're with somebody who's particularly angry or upset or afraid, they may not make very good decisions. They may not understand the situation particularly well. Even anxiety, which doesn't have to be terribly great, may have tremendous impact on people's thinking ability. A little bit of anxiety may be good for you. We call that facilitating anxiety because it makes you study harder. It makes you prepare better. It causes the adrenaline to flow a little bit, gets the blood to your brain, and may enhance your performance. But too much anxiety floods you, and we call it debilitating anxiety. Too much anxiety keeps you from thinking. It overwhelms the system, throws your thinking off track, and keeps you from studying effectively or preparing effectively or performing effectively in a situation. So it's the difference between somebody who has a little bit of anxiety and gets a little bit psyched up when she has to go out on stage and sing and experiences that as a rush that's helpful. And you want that, okay, because it gives you more power, it gives you more energy. There's a difference between that and the person who walks out on stage and becomes so anxious that she can't perform. It's stage fright. And where the line is between those two, a little bit's good for you and too much is terrible, where that line is differs for each of us. It varies, probably biologically, certainly on the basis of the experience that we've had. How many of you remember Mr. Rogers? Remember how he looked when he came through the door? How would you describe that? How would you describe Fred Rogers' face and activity when he came through the door singing, "It's a wonderful day in the neighborhood"? Did he look comfortable? Relaxed? Go back and look at it again. Fred Rogers had a wonderful case of stage fright, and one of the functions of his assistant producer for many years was to kick him through that door. And they often, they did that in Pittsburgh. It was one of my great pleasures to meet him and watch my kids grow up, my daughter particularly grow up, watching him. Magical man. I thought he was a real wimp. I'll tell you some another time. I'll tell you about Fred Rogers. But the assistant producer's job was to push him through the door, and they would sometimes tell him, "Okay, we're ready to roll," and he would go through the door and lose it, not remember the words or the tune, or not be able to do it. And they would sometimes do that 4 or 5 times. With no film in the cameras, because they knew it wasn't, they were not going to get a take that they could use. So they wouldn't even bother. 8, 9, 10 times, they'd finally get a take that they could use. And they used to joke about, "Well, what we need is just one, and then we'll just patch it in to every show." Because he would come out and he would stumble, he would be inarticulate, he would stutter. Incredibly articulate, wonderful man, but the idea of being on camera just created this terrible problem for him. And then he would get through it, but it would take him half an hour to get into it enough and get anxiety, the adrenaline would wear off and then he'd be okay. Okay? So the connection between anxiety or emotion and your ability to perform and make decisions and understand situations is an important connection. And through development, we sort out and separate intellect and emotion. It's one of the things that children are wrestling with, how not to be overwhelmed by their emotions. And as we go through adolescence and into adulthood, we still wrestle with that. How do I experience strong emotions and be comfortable with those and understand them, which is an intellectual task, and also, in the face of very strong emotions, make decisions, behave rationally, so that I don't frighten everybody by my strong emotions, so that I don't destroy my relationships by blowing up every time I get anxious. How do I keep from driving people away because they can't deal with my emotions? How do I keep a relationship going when I have difficulty dealing with somebody else's relationships? For a parent of an adolescent, that may be a very important task. How do I continue to be a supportive parent when my kid is losing it? How do I keep from getting into a shouting match with my kid? So separating the two domains, the biological and its emotional manifestation, and the cognitive, and then reintegrating them so that we can deal with both at the same time, is a developmental challenge. And being able to do that is one definition of maturity. Being able to experience the emotions, your own and other people's, and not lose your ability to behave rationally and supportively with the other person, not frighten the other person. That's a definition of maturity. We form emotional connections to other people, and we're going to talk about attachment. We're going to talk about friendship and romance, partnering. We also form attachments with the next generation. So we'll talk about parenting and parenting styles. The connections that we form change through development. All of our relationships change. Well, most of our relationships change. They become more complex, they become more intimate, more reciprocal, more mutual, more satisfying, more energetic, more stable, more contentious, or less. Understanding how relationships are changing and what causes the changes, what influences the change, why a relationship might become closer and why it might become more distant, is part of understanding development. People's relationships with their parents go from being completely dependent for your survival on your caregivers, particularly your parents, to being equals with them at some point, if they let you, and then eventually to having power of attorney over your parents and their finances and their well-being, and looking forward to making decisions for them when they're no longer competent to make their own decisions. That's a major shift in the parent-child relationship, and it's fairly predictable. All of us come in being completely dependent on our parents, and at the end of their lives, we may be responsible for them and their well-being, and they may be completely dependent on us. How does that shift in that balance take place? What causes it? Why does it happen, if it happens? And how do people respond to it and deal with it as they're going through adulthood? We lose connections to others. We break up, we move away, we disengage, we die, they die. Those are changes in relationships that influence our development, and dealing with them is part of our development. Knowing how to end a relationship, for example, is important. Most of us don't get any training in how to end a relationship, so we do it badly. And it's been done to you badly. It can be done well. It takes some planning and some maturity. But part of our development is dealing with people who are changing relationships with us. The last thing we're going to be talking about in this unit is what I call finding a path and a place in the world. And that's part of psychosocial development. How do I relate to the whole world? I was born into this earth. It's an expectable sort of place. I have expectable skills, expectable relationships. And I have to do things like support myself and be responsible and vote and figure out what my values are and understand the world that I'm in and figure out the world's place in the cosmos. How do I do that? That's all part of psychosocial development. Part of it is cognitive. Part of it is psychosocial. Where am I comfortable? Where do I want to live? What kind of relationships do I want to have? How do I deal with changes in the world? How do I understand them? How do I respond to them emotionally? How do I figure out how to deal with them? And part of psychosocial development is preparing to leave the world, since most of us don't get to stay here. More than, what was it we said in the biological unit, 120 years or so. We'll shoot for that. Okay. On Monday, we're going to start with the notion of temperament. We've started with emotions, which are physiological responses to situations, and I've suggested that we differ in our style of interpersonal relationships, and one of the ways we think about the variations among us is to see differences in how emotional we are, biologically what our rhythms are, what our typical responses to things are. So skim through at least that part of the chapter on infancy and toddlerhood that deals with temperament, and we'll start there on Monday.